Hello and welcome to the Maps Canada podcast. I'm your host, Siddharth Rangkadua. And as promised, our episodes will focus on a variety of topics related to psychedelics and science, history, and medicine. From time to time, however, we'll also offer conversations with leading researchers in the field, talking about their careers and distilling some of the key insights from their own work. Today, we're very excited to deliver our first interview on the show with psychedelic researcher Dr. Baraj Zaghetti. Baraj is a neuroscientist working at the Center of Psychedelic Research at Imperial College London. He earned degrees in mathematical physics from Imperial College and went on to complete a PhD in computational neuroscience at the University of Edinburgh. He also has experience as an engineer in biomedical software at the Icahn Institute of Genetics in New York. Baraj and his team have recently published a fascinating study on the effects of psychedelic microdosing on people's emotions, moods, as well as their abilities for cognitive tasks such as problem-solving and concentration. Now, microdosing is the practice of regularly using low, sub-perceptual doses of psychedelics, typically ranging between 0.1 to 0.4 grams of, say, dried psilocybin-containing mushrooms or 5 to 10 micrograms of LSD. There's no single standardized way of microdosing. Though, quite often, microdoses are consumed a couple of times a week, with a few days between each dose. And this is how the study we'll be discussing was implemented. Some people, however, may choose to take microdoses several days in a row, depending on their own schedule and goals. So, what's the point of microdosing then, if not to have a full-fledged psychedelic journey? When someone microdoses, they usually do it with the intent of enhancing their mood and general performance. People have often reported enhanced moods throughout the day or throughout their week, less stress, and a general sense of joy. Others report an enhanced ability to concentrate or find that microdosing helps them with creative problem solving. If you're curious to learn more, writer Ayelet Waldman outlines many of the perceived positive effects of microdosing in her best-selling 2017 book, A Really Good Day. Baraj's study investigates the outcome of repeated self-blinded microdosing in a sample population of 191 participants, which happens to be the largest placebo-controlled psychedelic study of any kind to date. The study also employed what's called a citizen science design. This method of conducting research is very exciting for the field of psychedelics, since it allows researchers to collaborate with volunteers around the world who are already using psychedelics in their home, collecting valuable data, without disrupting too much of their day-to-day life. All of this at a fraction of the cost of a typical lab-controlled clinical study. The aim of this study was to investigate the potential for any placebo effects in microdosing. In other words, Baraj and his team wondered whether the effects of microdosing were due to the psychedelic itself, or rather, the participants' own expectations. Now, I won't spoil any of the key findings here. This was a very engaging discussion for our first interview, and we look forward to sharing more of them with you soon. And without further ado, it's my pleasure to bring you Dr. Baraj Zaghetti. Baraj, thank you so much for coming onto the Maps Canada podcast.
Thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. And you're our first interview on the show. Can you tell us, Baraj, about how you got into psychedelics research?
2016, I went to a psychedelics research conference in Amsterdam. One of the major events that happened there is that I met with David Erizo, who is my main co-author on the microdose study as well. He is one of the senior clinicians at Imperial College London. So he's somebody who has a lot of experience running clinical studies. And at this conference, at the Amsterdam conference in 2016, I went there with a poster. And in that poster, I was criticizing some neuroimaging studies of MDMA. And the funny thing is that, like, you know, there was a person, you know, showing up at the poster and we started talking. And, you know, at my poster, I was continuously saying, but I think, you know, he has this paper, for example, by David Erizo, and I really disagree with that for reasons, so on and so on. And we had a really good conversation. At the very end of it, he introduced himself as being David Erizo, who I was criticizing for the past 50 minutes or so. But, you know, to his credit, he agreed, you know, with the criticism. So we started working together. And actually, right now, that's published work. So we have a sort of a reinterpretation of MDMA neuroimaging studies that we did together. And then we started working together, initially on that MDMA paper that I was just mentioning. And then towards the tail end of that project, that's when I had this idea for a self-blinding microdose study. And it was just very rational to call him first, just to see what he thinks. And you know, that was 2017, something like that. So we've been working together on this self-blinding microdose study since.
We'd love to hear your first pass at the study you have just published. I believe it's on Open Access. We'll link it in the show notes, of course. But tell us about the study you did with microdosing at the Imperial College.
Yes. So it's the self-blinding microdose study. And what makes this study special is its methodology, which we call self-blinding. And to put it briefly, what self-blinding is that we have developed a method how self-experimenters at home can implement their own placebo control without clinical supervision. So the way the study worked is that people who are microdosing anyway, they signed up for the study on our website, and then we send them a PDF document and a video that showed how they can implement their own placebo control, again, without ever coming to the clinic or seeing us. And I don't want to get lost in the details of how self-blinding works, but as a very high-level overview, the two key components is that first, we ask participants to hide their microdoses inside non-transparent gel capsules. And obviously, it's crucial that they are non-transparent because then the empty ones can be used as the placebo capsules in this study. So these two sets of capsules were prepared, and then they were put into zip bags and envelopes, and then those envelopes were shuffled, and there were some QR codes as well. You had to generate some random numbers, so on and so on and so on. But the net result of that process was that everybody ended up with capsules enough for 4 weeks without knowing which of those capsules is an empty one and which of those capsules has a microdose inside. The other crucial element of the experiment was is that when participants scanned the aforementioned QR codes that linked with the IT infrastructure of our study, so we had a way of tracking who is doing microdose and who is doing placebos at what time. So that's, you know, the self-blinding methodology. And you know, to give you a little bit more of a context here, like traditionally, you know, in research in this area, you have the observational studies, the retrospective and the prospective observational studies, when, you know, a researcher just, you know, constructs a survey, puts it online, and then participants complete it. And then there are the full-blown clinical studies where everything is super well controlled with the placebo control. And, you know, there is nothing really in between these two sort of like study categories in terms of like rigor. And what's exciting about this self-blinding methodology is that it sits somewhere in between the two. Like, I don't want to, you know, sell this study as a clinical study. It's clearly not a clinical study. But on the other hand, it is clearly superior to an observational study because it has that placebo control element. So, you know, what's exciting about this is that we have found a way to run placebo control studies outside of the clinic that are very, very cheap to do. And just to give you a little bit of a comparison, our costs of this study were about 1% of an equivalent clinical study. And the other major benefit of self-blinding is because everything is run on the internet, you can reach a global audience. And because of that, this was actually the largest placebo-controlled study on psychedelics to date, not just among microdose studies, but psychedelic studies in general.
Well, and you're right. You're right to mention that it is this kind of in-between it's not a clinically controlled study. You're not working with clinical populations, but it has a bit more ecological validity, or we can trust it more than just observational data on Arrowhead, let's say, because there is a blinding procedure that you give them and then they follow it. Just in general, also, it seems logistically there are a lot of things that you don't have to worry about as a researcher by resorting to an online study like this. For instance, where are you going to get the microdoses? Who's going to synthesize them? Where's storage? Who's the personnel who's going to be authorized to use it? You just kind of can trust people in the comfort of their own home who already have experience with this drug to use it, and then they'll collect the data for you. And I guess in this time of COVID-19, that's especially appropriate. Can you tell us about how you partitioned the participants? What groups did you have, and exactly what measures were you collecting?
Okay, so let me step back and then just tell you a little bit generally about the structure of the study. So first participants signed up and they did this self-blinding procedure, and then they were doing taking capsules for 4 weeks. And the way the study was structured is that there were three groups. First there was the microdose group, and these were the people who were taking microdoses for the entire 4 weeks. There was the placebo group who were just doing placebos for the entire 4 weeks. And also there was a group that we called half-half, and these were the people who were doing microdoses and placebos half of the time. But for the purpose of this discussion, I'm going to ignore that group because it's not that interesting. Where it's much more interesting is the pure microdose versus pure placebo group comparison. In terms of the outcomes, before we actually run the real study, we ran a very small pilot study with experienced microdosers, about 7 or 8 of them. And we showed them a bunch of questionnaires and asked them that, hey, what do you think? What are the ones here that capture best the effects of microdosing? And what was our primary outcome is what is called the RIF psychological well-being scale. So that's what we defined in the study documents as the primary outcome. And like, you know, it's a measure of general well-being. And of course, you know, that is something which is very often associated with microdosing. Mm. But we also measured depression scores, anxiety scores, general emotional state. And also we measured cognitive performance. So not only we measured psychological profiles, but we also measured cognitive performance. Mm. And that was a little bit different compared to the other ones because that was like an actual proper computer-based test. That it was a company that we teamed up with, and we used their platform. So participants had to log into that platform and complete various cognitive tests. Think about the number of digits that you can recall in reverse order, or like those memory card games that probably you were playing as a child as well. So we measured cognitive performance through computerized version of those games.
Mm, nice. And it was the Cambridge Brain Sciences test battery, if I remember correctly, yes?
That's correct.
Right. Well, that's great. And so you kind of had the whole gamut of things that capture what microdosers report, which is, you know, sense of well-being, a difference in psychological profile before and after, and just enhanced creativity, abstract thinking, better focus. There's a variety of things that you hear in the microdosing community. Now, kind of turning towards your essential findings, you compared baseline to, was it 5 weeks later?
Four weeks. So that is what we call the accumulative outcomes. And what we find there is it's a mixed bag. Hmm. So there are like two comparisons that we have made. And first, we just looked at the microdose group alone. And when we looked at the change from baseline to after this 4 weeks long dose regime, what we have found is that on all of the psychological outcomes, microdosers did improve significantly. So in a way, this actually confirms the anecdotal evidence for microdosing. Our data is very clear that microdosers did better after 4 weeks of microdosing than before. Mm. However, when the picture is going to get a bit more muddy and also more exciting, is if when you add in the placebo control group, because what we saw is that people in the placebo control group also improved on all of the scales that we have measured. And once we did the comparison between the improvements in the microdose group versus improvement in the placebo control group, then the difference was not significant anymore, not on any of the scales that we have measured, including any of the subscales. So I think, you know, like what that means is that like microdosing does improve, you know, psychological well-being. Our data is very clear about that. But you can get the same benefits from taking deceptive placebos as taking microdoses. And the keyword is the deceptive. I would not expect people just taking empty capsules to feel better. But here in this experiment, of course, there was that element that you did not know what you are taking is either a microdose or a placebo. So it was a deceptive placebo. Mm. And I think that was very crucial to trigger that placebo effect. So when the results came out, obviously it was disappointment to many microdosers, and many people asked us whether microdosing work, what does our results mean exactly? And, you know, whether microdosing works or not, it's not a binary question. It's a lot more complicated than that. So our data is very, very clear that if you make the comparison from baseline to after the 4 weeks, we saw improvements in a wide range of psychological outcomes. So microdosing does work in that sense, no question about it. However, you can get the same benefits by taking deceptive placebos. So if you ask, you know, whether microdosing works better than deceptive placebos, then the answer is no, at least according to our data. Our data shows that the benefits of microdosing are real, but the mechanism behind those benefits is not linked to the pharmacological effect of the microdosing. It's not because of the microdose itself, the biological, the chemical effect that it has on your brain that makes you feel better. Rather, it is all of the psychological expectations that you have about microdosing. And this is something that I would really like to emphasize, that people who are microdosing, not just in our study, but people who microdose generally, that's not a random sample from the population. These are almost always people who are psychedelic enthusiasts, who have good experiences with taking large doses of psychedelics. And that's really a key element of having a strong placebo response, because you are excited about doing it. Like, you know, there is one analogy, you know, that you can think about is that, think about two kind of people who are microdosing, and think about one of them are sort of like, let's say, you know, people who are non-hippies, you know, people who have never taken psychedelics, you know, and it is just not, you know, something that is cool for them. It is not something that they resonate with them. They would be much less enthusiastic about taking microdoses because, you know, for them, you know, it's like this, oh, this is probably dangerous drug, you know, you get the substance from the black market, you know, it just wouldn't feel really, really good. And that enthusiasm gap, you know, that is very critical, you know, when you're trying to assess the placebo effect. Mm-hmm. And in the current study, and generally in microdosing, there is a strong placebo response because people are very enthusiastic about it. So when we launched the study, we knew that there is going to be a strong placebo response. The real question was whether that's going to be whether the effects of microdosing is going to be larger than the placebo response. And we find the answer to be no to that specific question.
Right. Yeah. Well, again, I think the story that emerges from this paper and the data is much more interesting and nuanced than does microdosing work? It's because it actually kind of begs us to consider, what is it about the participant who microdoses that makes it work when it does? You know, just to pull from your paper, you know, there is this idea, I think it's in the paper, but you say that it's not the contents of the capsule that matter, but more so the beliefs about what's in the capsule. And then there are genuine improvements in the microdosing condition, but it's probably, you know, can be chalked up to, you know, the interaction between expectations, if they've guessed or if they assume that they have a microdose, and all the things they think that should do to performance.
Yeah, exactly. So, you know, the part that you are referring to, that is a little bit of a different analysis that we did, but it's probably worth it to spell that out. So previously, I was talking about these changes over time. And just a little bit of an aside, like, that's actually really exciting because this is the first study that assessed the first placebo-controlled study that assessed the effects of repeated microdosing. Mm-hmm. All of the other placebo-controlled studies on microdosing, they only assess the effects of a single administration. So, you know, getting back to the main line now, we, other than these long-term outcomes, we also assessed acute outcomes. So how you feel a few hours after you have taken the capsule. And the way this worked is that for participants, on every Thursday, they took a capsule in the morning, and we asked them to complete questionnaires 2 to 6 hours later during that day. So why they were presumably still under the influence if they have taken a microdose. And what's interesting here is that at the very end of the questionnaire of the test, we asked them to take a guess that, based on their experiences that they had during that day, was this a microdose or was this a placebo that they took earlier that day?
Does this not lend support to kind of this already existing theory in psychedelics therapy, in the psychedelics literature, is that expectations, prior beliefs play a huge role in in their therapeutic action for psychotherapy. Is there some sense in which these findings aren't surprising?
Yes, absolutely. I think, you know, you are 100% correct, you know, that in a sense, our results are not very surprising. But what makes it different compared to the large dose cases is exactly what we talked about before, is that with the large doses, you can't really make placebo control. And, you know, people understand that, you know, when it comes to the large doses, it's just impossible to do the blinding. But like here, you know, with this case, you know, we have blinding that works much better than in most psychiatric trials. And yet we see the same effects in terms of like in the expectations playing a key role. And then obviously, you know, the next question is that if this is true, you know, for psychedelics, is it also true for more conventional forms of medicine? And actually, this is what I am working on right now, is to have a reanalysis of some studies with SSRIs in the light of what we learned with the study on microdosing. And I'm just doing that analysis right now, so I can't give you the results. But like, you know, there is some resemblance, certainly. So we think that's going to be another exciting paper.
Yeah. Well, it's just, it's really interesting, you know, because there's this question of how we should make sense of, you know, the role of expectations if we're microdosing or taking higher doses of psychedelics. Does the fact that expectations can influence performance, does that delegitimize psychedelics as an intervention? Or should we view that as support for the role of expectations in successful therapy? You can kind of go one of two ways. The point of placebo control, in some sense, is to isolate the benefits to just the drug and know that it is the drug working mechanistically in the body versus,
the psychological jumble mumble on top of it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think one issue, you know, with this whole placebo control is that it's very, very personal, you know, what you are going to have a large placebo response and to what you're going to have a small placebo response. Here, I actually have a personal story. And it's that I was flying overseas. It was while we were doing the studies. But anyway, I was flying from Europe to the US. And during the plane, my ear was getting very, very painful. You know, I mean, I felt that an ear infection is coming up. And when we landed in the US, it was like in the late afternoon. And by the time I was able to go to a pharmacy, like, you know, all of them, all of the proper pharmacies were closed. And you were only able to buy, you know, just this over-the-counter stuff. So and I was looking for something for my ear, and I only find homeopathic medicine. And like, you know, homeopathy is by and large shown to be just a placebo response. So then, you know, initially I just put it back, you know, I'm not going to waste my money, you know, on homeopathy. And I was heading out of the shop. But then I was like, but man, you know, my ears are really, really hurting. I really do need something. And I can't see a doctor tonight, you know, like maybe there is something to homeopathy. And I made the little self-experiment. I pulled out my phone and I started to read positive stories about homeopathy. And I tried to put aside my scientific self as much as I could. So I was standing there and reading positive stories about homeopathy on my phone for 50 minutes, bought the homeopathic medicine, and then treated myself. And I had a pretty cool and calm evening. It definitely helped me. The next day, I still went to see a proper doctor and I got an antibiotic, you know, that fixed it. And like, you know, I wouldn't expect, you know, homeopathy to work, you know, in the long term of being able to fix, you know, that infection. But it really did help me out, you know, through that one night, you know, that I couldn't have any other remedy available. And, you know, that's even for me, somebody who is very scientific and rational minded. So, you know, the power of the mind is in place even for cold-hearted scientists like myself.
Yeah, well, that's very commendable of you to, you know, talk yourself into the other position.
Yes, absolutely.
And you get the best of both worlds, right? Where you can have antibiotics and then when that's in short supply, just pull out your homeopathic testimonies.
Yeah, exactly. And then, you know, it goes back to a little bit to microdosing as well. Obviously, I get asked a lot, so you know, is microdosing work? And I think, you know, it works if you believe in it. If you have positive expectations about it, then you will get benefits, no question about it. Taking the safety placebos is sufficient to get those benefits, but I think, you know, by and large, most people don't care that much about what is the mechanism behind those benefits. Mm-hmm. So I was saying earlier, like, you know, our data is clear that the benefits of microdosing are clear. It just argues that the mechanism behind them are not pharmacological. They are linked to psychology. Apparently, most microdosers care whether they feel better because of, you know, it's a pharmacological mechanism or a psychological mechanism.
So, I mean, you kind of mentioned this at the beginning, is that this study is kind of, it straddles in the in-between between observational research and being a clinical controlled trial. You weren't looking for dose-dependent factors necessarily, so it's not a clinical trial, and you're working with a relatively healthy population. So what are the limitations of this design, just kind of broadly, and how does that inform what you'll... my understanding is that you're going to also do another study, kind of a 2.0 kind of thing. So can you speak a bit about the limitations of the approach you just kind of accomplished and how you might change that for future?
Yes. So the big standout limitation of the study is that people have used their own drug, which they have sourced from the black market. Mm. So there are some uncertainties with respect to the specific chemical in the sample and the exact dosage that was used. That being said, actually, I don't think it's that bothersome when it comes to microdosing. And the reason for that is because people who are microdosing also get their psychedelics from the black market. So it's not like, you know, that what, you know, gave hype to microdosing, you know, in that circle, you know, everybody's getting legal psychedelics where they know their LSD amount, you know, with microgram precisions. So, you know, we put it in the paper. I think this is the right way of putting this limitation, is that our study is not representative of a clinical microdosing regime where everything would be like, you know, super well controlled. But what our study is representative of is real-life microdosing. Real people microdosing in the real world as it is done in practice, because then you have the same uncertainties as present in our study. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when it comes to microdosing, I think, you know, what's also crucial is that this is like an underground phenomena. You know, it started that way. You could say, you know, that like our study, you know, takes care of those anecdotal evidence. What we show is that those anecdotal benefits, you know, they can be explained by the placebo effect. And so, you know, once you put those anecdotes aside, you know, then what you're left with are three very small clinical studies that are also by and large negative. I mean, you know, I don't want to say anything conclusive about microdosing because there have only been 4 placebo-controlled studies, including ourselves. So, you know, it is early days of microdosing research. But at this point, you know, I would say, you know, it doesn't look very promising that there are going to be big significant effects beyond the placebo effect. Maybe we chat again, like, you know, say in 10 years' time, you know, when there are many more clinical studies, then, you know, the evidence may up that, yeah, microdosing does work. It very well could be the case. But based on the limited sample that we have, you know, it is, I think it does not look very promising is the way I would put it. And, you know, one small disclaimer here, of course, is like every other study, like our study also, you know, does not exclude, you know, a microdose placebo difference. It just puts, you know, a boundary, you know, of how big that difference can be. So it very well could be the case, you know, that there is a very small drug placebo difference. But, you know, whether the difference is clinically significant or not, that's the other important aspect, you know, which needs to be considered.
Right.
I think this is worth spelling out because this is something which is not often discussed. So what people tend to focus on whether there is a statistically significant difference between two conditions, but that's only half of the story. But arguably it's much more important whether the magnitude of those differences is clinically significant or not.
I think your point is valid, and that it reminds us why people ever want to microdose or macrodose to begin with. They're not interested. You know, people don't take a psychedelic typically because it's been reported in the literature that there's a statistically significant different effect. It's that there's something to gain in going through a 4 to 6 hour trip or just having a slightly better day. People do it for the clinically significant outcomes and not necessarily what a p-value could tell you.
Absolutely, yeah. Let's talk about antidepressants. So antidepressants, the efficacy is typically measured on what is called the Hamilton scale. And if you look at the big latest meta-analysis of all SSRI-based antidepressants, then typically patients in the placebo control groups improve about 8 points on this scale. If you take an SSRI, on average, they improve 10 points. Mm. So, you know, the difference is only 2 points. So about 80%, you know, of the response, you know, to SSRIs is already contained, you know, in the placebo response group. And there is an ongoing scientific argument whether that 2 point on this particular scale that's clinically significant or not. But one important thing to say here is that when you're a real patient in real life taking an SSRI, you're always doing that in an open label manner, meaning that you exactly know what you are taking because the doctor have prescribed to you. And, you know, when you check out your pharmacy, you know, it's not that, you know, they either give you placebo or an SSRI.
Can you imagine your pharmacist saying, it's a surprise? What's in it? It's a surprise.
Exactly. So, like, you know, it is, even though, like, you know, a large response to the SSRIs is already contained in the placebo control groups, but it's also important to trigger those expectations.
Another initiative I know that Imperial College, your team is working on is an upcoming app that is linked to, I guess, this citizen science approach of openly available online psychedelic research for people who are already in this sphere. Can you tell us about, I believe it was called MyDelica?
Exactly, yes. So MyDelica is an app that you will be able to download very, very soon. And MyDelica is funded by Robin Carhart-Harris, a very well-known psychedelic researcher, also at Imperial College. Disclaimer, right now I work in his lab, so you know it's not a complete coincidence that we are going to work on it together. MyDelica is a tool for people who want to get most out of their psychedelic use. So MyDelica is a tool to guide how you can get the most benefits out of psychedelic experiences. And it also gives you a way to track your progress in various domains that you are interested in improving by using psychedelics. So that is going to be the core of MyDelica, but we're also planning to use MyDelica as a research platform. And indeed, there is a self-blinding microdose study 2.0 coming, launching towards the very end of the year or most likely Q1 of next year. So it's going to be the same self-blinding kind of study that we have run here, but we are going to do a few things differently. It's just based on what we have learned based on this first study. So it's going to be still the same elements in terms of like you having to prepare capsules. There are still going to be the days when you take placebo and microdose. But when you are taking the capsules, how long you are taking them, it's going to be slightly different. Also, we want to use different scales. And also, we would be very interested in trying to get people who have some diagnosis for a mental health condition. One of the key limitations of the study that we haven't mentioned yet is that the sample is very, very healthy. So you could imagine is that like the reason why we didn't see a placebo microdose difference is because there was people were already feeling really good relative to the average population. Right. So if you're very healthy, you have very good well-being, then there is just not that much scope for improving. You know, that's an open question at this point. In the current study, we sort of created a pseudo-depressed population by looking at people whose well-being were at the bottom 25% at baseline. And we reanalyzed the data just looking at those people. And then we didn't find any placebo microdose difference either. So our data doesn't support that is going to work better for depressed people or not. But, you know, this is like a bit of a workaround. You know, it's not really the same as like having people who are in the study who are having a depression diagnosis. So anyway, we are just developing that study protocol. So there is still open questions regarding that. But it's going to be running on the MyDelica app. MyDelica itself is going to be launching hopefully somewhere during the summer. But for people who are interested, please feel free to visit the website, mydelica.com, and you can already sign up for early bird access.
Nice. I have a couple of questions on what you just kind of mentioned there. Are there added challenges seeking out a clinical population with this kind of online citizen science methodology versus a healthy population, whether it's harder to pass it through ethics?
Exactly. That's it. That's
right.
It. Full stop.
I'm a researcher too, so I get it. What kind of hurdles are you going to have to jump, do you anticipate, in kind of finding a clinical population? Or what are the concerns that an ethics board might have once you switch your participants?
So obviously, you know, microdosing is not currently a proven medication. You know, we can argue, you know, how strong is the evidence in favor of it, but, you know, you cannot make the argument, you know, that this is a well accepted form of medication. Mm. So then, you know, to people who, let's stick with depression just for the sake of a specific example, then, you know, to target people, you know, who are depressed, you know, with an unproven medication, I mean, you can obviously see, you know, some of the ethical dilemma with that. We actually wanted to recruit a clinical population with this first study as well, but then we basically pulled it out from the protocol last second because there were so many novelty with self-blinding, you know, to begin with, is that we just felt that we might be pushing it too hard. Like, we already wanted to do this completely new methodology with psychedelics, you know, beyond that, you know, we try to keep it as simple as possible. But, like, you know, right now, the good news is that we have shown, you know, that self-blinding as a methodology works. We also show that it's very valuable, and also there were no any hiccups during the study in terms of, like, you know, let's say participants overdosing, you know, or you know, having any accidents like that.
What other studies has this current project informed for the future? Are you going to take this design for other questions?
Absolutely. That's exactly the plan. So right now, what we are busy with is developing a self-blinding CBD oil study. So CBD oil, much like microdosing, has generated a lot of hype, but there's not much sound scientific research on the benefits of CBD oil. So, you know, because of the hype, you know, on one hand and the lack of clinical research on the other, you know, that could also be the case, you know, that the benefits of CBD oil can be explained by the placebo effect. Mm. And as I said, we are just working on that study protocol right now. I think it's realistic that it's going to launch Q3, Q4 of this year, something like that. And it's going to be also the same self-blinding study logic. So, you know, people who are using CBD oil at home, we're going to give you a protocol and you can implement your own placebo control. And then you can see for yourself whether CBD oil has benefits for you beyond the placebo effect. Beyond the CBD oil, we are having a number of discussions in the background for various interventions, including nootropics, to run various self-blinding studies. And really the long-term future of what I would like to do is to have a completely open science self-blinding platform where people can test whatever intervention they are interested in, with self-blinding being on top of it. It would be an open science platform, so the anonymized version of all the data ever collected would always be accessible to everybody. And it would be a very powerful tool, you know, to test, you know, what medications have effect in the in a real life context. Mm. There's a very interesting debate right now going on in the medical literature whether what is the place of clinical studies in judging whether something is efficient or not.
Right.
So clinical studies, like, they're the most well-controlled, and that's what we associate with science. But clinical studies often control away the context of real life. So one very common example is that through inclusion criteria, in most clinical studies, people who are participating, they are much younger and healthier and have a higher socioeconomic status than the general population. So you might develop a medicine, you know, that works very well, you know, for people in their, you know, mid-30s who are high earners. But, you know, does that same medication is going to work for elderly people who have, you know, let's say high blood sugar, you know, to begin with and have some other ongoing condition? So, you know, when you develop a medicine, the final question is not whether that works in a clinical study. The final question is whether it works in real life.
Right.
And we think, you know, with this self-blinding platform, we could address that question actually better than clinical studies.
Well, this is something that I was thinking as I was reading your paper, was that it has more validity than traditional observational research, but not as much as a clinical study. But I had this feeling that what you're capturing is real, what we would call ecological validity, in that you've introduced the intervention in the real world, and you've randomly sampled. And you know, calling back to the paper, whatever method you did to partition participants in the three different groups, there were no huge differences on any category between participants in the three groups. They were fairly randomized, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And each individual is exposed to the myriad of different other factors that a lab study wouldn't want, because they want control. But I think the benefit to being exposed to all those factors is that, again, you're testing the drug you're testing the drug where the participant will be taking the drug.
Exactly. Yeah.
And that is huge, right?
Yeah, this is a topic very close to my heart.
It's a fine line, right? Because you don't want to discredit the value of a clinically controlled study, because we want to also be certain about the efficacy or mechanisms of the drug alone, separate from expectations. It's an interesting in between your study has, you know, found.
In the paper, you know, we had to say it's first in a clinical study because it's less well controlled. And that's true in a sense. I'm not denying that. But you're correct that there is another sense, which actually I think is more important, where it is better than a clinical study, exactly because it is less well controlled, exactly because it is in the context of real life, where sometimes, you know, you are going to forget to take your capsule, for example, where there is a lot more going on, where you don't meet the clinicians. It's well known from placebo research that the biggest component of the placebo response is doctor-patient interaction, and that distorts clinical studies immensely to begin with. Because, you know, when you are enrolling in a clinical study, there is a lot of medical attention on you that you are not getting in primary care. You know, when you are depressed, you know, it's and you are prescribed, you know, SSRIs, you know, maybe you talk to your doctor for like 15, 20 minutes. It's much, much more in a clinical study with multiple people who want to make sure, you know, that there is not going to be any serious adverse side effects, you know, because it's a trial, you know, it's just a very different atmosphere, much more, there's just a lot more time devoted to the patient. And that time, that care is going to drive up the placebo response, which is then completely missing from the real life. So, you know, in that sense, yes, our study is less well controlled, but it is closer to that real life application.
Right. Yeah. Can we draw any analogies between what's going on in microdosing with the subperceptual effects, the very small doses that sometimes one can barely notice, and the methods or techniques of homeopathic medicine? Are there strong connections between what's going on for both of these interventions?
So I think what's interesting is that, you know, try to project the future of microdosing based on homeopathy. Mm. So, like, you know, let's say, you know, that our results will, you know, stand the test of time. And again, you know, like I'm not saying, you know, is that our results are conclusive or definitive, but let's just assume that, you know, for the sake of argument, you know, there is no benefits of microdosing beyond the placebo effect. What that would mean for the future of microdosing. So homeopathy is interesting in this context because with microdosing, there are only 4 placebo-controlled studies. So the science is unsettled. But with homeopathy, there are hundreds of studies that show that there is nothing more to it than the placebo effect. Yet, homeopathy doesn't stop being a profitable business. I mean, I was able to buy my homeopathic medicine, you know, because it is alive despite the overwhelming scientific evidence of it not having any effect. So, you know, obviously I'm in contact, you know, with microdose entrepreneurs, you know, and some of them were very disappointing, you know, by our results. But I keep telling them, no worry, like, you know, your business is safe. Mm. As long as, you know, there's positive expectations about microdosing, you know, I think, you know, people are still going to do it. And bear in mind, you know, from what we discussed previously, I think, you know, there are real benefits to microdosing. It's just that the mechanism behind those are expectations. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as long as, you know, those expectations are kept up by advertisement or whatever other means, I expect that people are going to get benefits from microdosing. And microdosing as a phenomena is going to stay alive.
With regards to Mydelica, so you talked a bit about the research component to it, but for the average consumer, what's the experience going to be like? How will it help people with their journeys and track kind of the progress that they make?
So there is a big psychoeducational component to Mydelica, which comes in the form of videos. So when the app releases and when you download it, you will be access to high quality content about how to best use psychedelics. And this is done by Robin. And like, you know, he knows, you know, a lot about psychedelics. So, you know, that's advice coming from him. And then, you know, the at least in the initial release, what we are planning, what's going to be the core Mydelica journey structure is that you are going to get specific contents at specific times prior to your journey or, you know, prior to your psychedelic experience. And obviously, this is going to be tailored so that you can get the most out of your psychedelic experience. And then also before and after your experience, you can select what questionnaires you would like to complete. And these are all questionnaires that have been used in psychological research and have been validated by external researchers. So that gives you a way, you know, of tracking the progress before and after the trip. And we also give you some very nice visual feedback on where you are in the population with your current scores, how much have you improved, like, you know, the magnitude of your improvement, how does that compare relative to the average experience, you know, among people who are also using Mydelica. But we have some further components planned for Mydelica down the line. So this is just Mydelica core, you know, we could say it like that. But we have some tricks up our sleeves and, you know, there's going to be some cool stuff coming to the app.
Well, that's amazing. It's just hearing you talk about it, it's amazing to reflect at how far psychedelics have come in our culture. I mean, in the past 20 years, I mean, now we're having apps.
Oh, past five, I think.
Past five, you know. Yeah, honestly. It's pretty wild because, I mean, now it's kind of, it's on everyone's radar now in a way that it wasn't a few years ago. And now there are fabulous apps and, you know, open access articles that people can kind of check out for themselves to kind of dispel a lot of the stigma, you know, that surrounded them for so long.
You know, going back to Mydelica, like, you know, one thing which I would like to emphasize regarding this is that it's currently very popular, you know, in the use, you know, to use psychedelics. But I have the suspicion, you know, is that many people don't get much out of their psychedelic use because, you know, many people are using it in a party or, you know, recreational context. And to be clear, I have zero problem with people taking psychedelics at parties. But psychedelic use is a little bit different if you want to do it with self-developmental purposes.
Right.
You can be a seasoned psychedelic partygoer, you know, who goes to Burning Man every year. But it doesn't really mean, you know, is that you have the best practices of how to get most out of psychedelics, you know, as a tool for self-improvement. So, like, you know, that's, you know, a big part of the, or like that's, you know, the image of the user that, you know, we had in mind, you know, when we developed Mydelica. And of course, you know, the other image, the other, you know, idealized user are people who are completely new to psychedelics. But then what I would like to emphasize, you know, is that what Mydelica is a tool for, if you would like to use psychedelics for self-improvement purposes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think that's why in developing this podcast, you know, where our first couple of episodes, we'll be looking at, for instance, the history of psychedelics, specifically just in Canada. And there is this history that we have with these compounds that started with fascinating research in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and then war on drugs. It's all kind of swept away, intense propaganda, fear mongering. And so I think initiatives like Mydelica will really help with kind of dispelling a lot of the things that people have been told about psychedelics, which aren't true. And this idea that psychedelics today, they're very much part of the well-being culture that's emerged in the past, 10, 15 years or so that's kind of associated to ideas of mindfulness and self-growth and well-being. So I think it's great. And we're all really looking forward to the app when it comes out. And so, yeah, we'll urge listeners to sign up as beta testers if that's at all possible.
Thank you. Yeah. So, you know, going back to this notion of like, you know, psychedelics and current culture, and what fascinates me is that like right now we are probably at peak psychedelics. Psychedelic as exciting as they are ever going to be. I think psychedelics very soon are going to be approved for medical use in the Western culture. Mm-hmm. And I have a hard time imagining it then not being approved in a little bit longer timescale, but in some form of, you know, well-being enhancement, but something, you know, which is not to treat a specific condition. Mm. But anyway, my point is that like, you know, 20 years down the line, you know, when you are depressed and your doctor like prescribes you yet another mushroom trip, you know, it's going to have a very different vibe, you know, around psychedelics, you know, when it is just going to be your average treatment, you know, that everybody did, that everybody does, you know, and right now, you know, there is a bit of a mysticism around psychedelics because they are still illegal, you know, practically everywhere in the world, you know. It's only a selected few who had the psychedelic experience, you know, who had access to these substances. Yeah. So there is, you know, a lot of mysticism around psychedelics, you know, which synergizes really well with their effects. But, you know, a lot of that shine, you know, is going to come off, you know, once it's going to be yet another medication. And make no mistake, you know, this is also going to be a psychedelic industry, you know, that's going to have some questionable practices. And, you know, there are going to be bad actors in this space, like in any other for business sector. So I think, you know, a lot of that coolness, that excitement, that mystery, that shine is going to come off. And as we just discussed previously, like, you know, the belief and the expectation are so important to psychedelics. So, you know, what I often wonder about is that, like, right now, you know, what we see with the efficacy of the large-scale studies, is that going to persist, like, 30 years down the line when, you know, all of these extra pharmacological effects are gone or minimized, simply being psychedelics, just being another boring medicine again. And I think, you know, that's the most exciting question, or at least to me, is that, you know, how psychedelics, how the interaction between efficacy and culture, how that interaction is going to change, you know, the landscape of psychedelics and their medical use. Because I would bet quite a lot, you know, that it is going to change, and it is likely right now we have the best studies in terms of like the effect sizes and the efficacy of psychedelics. It's only going to go down from here. But, you know, the question is that how much they are going to go down.
Right.
But the good news is that, as we discussed, the effect sizes are pretty big, so there is a pretty good leeway. So, like, you know, even if they lose a few points of efficacy here and there, there is still enough to remain to be optimistic about the future of psychedelics. But, you know, let's discuss this again in 30 years.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah, we'll give you a call. We're on a very, we're on an extremely exciting road ahead to getting these things standardized therapeutically and developing like therapeutic models on how a therapist should be in the room with the participant. And so, yeah, there are a lot of things and research like yours will like heavily inform how we end up implementing these in, you know, clinical context. So we really appreciate all of your work. And Baraj, thank you so much for just being here to chat with us. And it was a real pleasure. So yeah, thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to the MAPS Canada podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review and sharing it with your friends and family. As you may already know, MAPS Canada is a nonprofit charity, and this podcast is brought to you by your team of dedicated volunteers. If you'd like to support us by making a donation, please visit our donation page linked in the show notes. If you'd like to learn more about how you can get involved in our work, please visit our website at mapscanada.org. We appreciate your support. It goes a long way in our effort towards the legalization of psychedelics and ensuring their access as safe medicines for all Canadians.